She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And believe me, we are going to give you lots to think about today. Our show was made possible due to the generous support of the Chapman Automotive Group, always doing their share and showing they care. And we thank them for the great work they do in our community and for their support. So the name of our show today is A Daily Dose of Nature, and I am very honored to have an internationally known advocate for just that. His name is Richard Louv, and I want to make sure I say your name right, Richard, and you can jump up and correct me. Richard is the author of The Nature Principle and Last Child in the Woods, a national bestseller, and co-founder and chairman emeritus of the Children and Nature Network. So, Richard, how did I do on your name?
Perfect.
Okay, good. I always want to do that. It's such a disgrace if I don't. In the next hour, we'll hope to adequately discuss each of these informative and compelling books, as well as spend some time talking about the Children and Nature Network. So everybody, really and truly get ready for a content-rich and thought-provoking next hour. I told Richard off-air this should have been part of a three-part series, because I did read Last Child in the Woods, and it is sad and hopeful and informative and educational and depressing and sad. And the beat goes on. So let's start quickly where we talk about you. And I guess my first question I always like to ask, and we can cover it very quickly, is when were the seeds of your absolute, very clear love, respect, and passion for nature being planted? What happened to make you this unbelievable, internationally known advocate for being in the woods?
Well, thanks for the kind words first. Actually, the seeds were planted in the field and the woods behind my house when I was a kid. I actually was a kid once, and I spent much of my boyhood in those woods and fields with my dog, which was a collie, and much of that time was alone, or it was with other kids in the neighborhood. I would design the treehouse, and then I would get them to do the heavy lifting. And
so you were a leader.
I don't know, something like that. So I loved those woods, and they loved me, and I knew that, and I didn't know I knew that particularly, but I wouldn't have been able to articulate it then. But I found something there that was bigger than my parents and their problems. But I had good parents who gave me that gift of nature. Now, I had free run of those woods. I was truly a free-range kid. And I had such a sense of ownership of those woods. I mean, they were my woods. Like a lot of people, I had a special place in nature, and my woods were my special place. And I had such a sense of ownership that I pulled out, I think, hundreds of survey stakes that I knew had something to do with the bulldozers that were taking out other woods. I had a developer tell me a few years ago that I would have been much more successful at holding off bulldozers if I'd simply moved the survey stakes around. But, you know, that sense of ownership, and that's sometimes a controversial word, can we truly own nature? But I use that word because it's how I felt, and it's how a lot of people feel. But at the same time, those woods own me, and they're still in my heart. I can go to those woods sometimes in my heart, and I can find something there that I can't find a kind of peacefulness and strength. And those woods did finally get torn down by the bulldozers, but they remain inside me.
Right.
And that's true of many people who had some special place when they were a kid in nature. And so the big question of Last Child in the Woods and of this movement is, will kids in the future generations, have that place to go in their heart? That's not a guarantee. They may not.
You know, Richard, mine was a creek. We had a creek. I'm a Jersey girl. And believe it or not, we just, we would go up the creek. And to this day, we called them punks, but they were cattails that we would just gather all the punks. And I don't know where that name came from, and light them. I mean, it was safe to do at night to keep away the mosquitoes. And one of the things that I hear when you're talking is, we weren't afraid. I was never afraid to go in the woods. There are streets in Tucson that I don't really want to go in. But when I'm in the woods, I'm not afraid. And did you? Clearly, you had no fear anywhere in the woods. Is that right? It was a freedom.
Yeah, it was a freedom. And one of the things I often say is that, you know, that parents and by contagion, their kids increasingly fear nature. And I never say that nature is risk-free. There are things to fear in the natural world. I know that because as an older kid, I collected poisonous snakes, but never quite got around to tell my parents.
Yeah, that's not a good idea.
Yeah. But so there is danger in nature, but that's one of its attractions. And you know, I was a little extreme with the snakes, but that was later on when I was a teenager. There is danger out there. And again, that's part of what kids need. They need to take small or smallish risks. If they don't do that, if they don't learn that kind of independence and ability to be resilient and ability to get back up on their feet after they fall off a log, and the ability to learn that the next time they get on a log, it better not be one that rolls easily. If they don't learn that early, what in the world are they going to do when they encounter really big risks later as a teenager?
Right.
So that is preparation for life. And increasingly, we disallow that kind of preparation for life, and then we wonder why our kids aren't so resilient.
Right. And I have to do a little disclaimer because I got leeches on me once in a while when I go up the creek.
Oh, I did too.
And boy, did I. I was really scared then. And then one time my sister and I went exploring on the ice and it broke and I got pulled under and she pulled me out by my hair. So I don't mean I was like totally fearless, but it wasn't the same kind of fear of being hurt. It was a natural fear that made you want to explore and have your senses heightened and look around. So, yeah, I was probably the chicken of the family, but I always went because I was the third kid. But anyway, let's go back to
I went through the leech initiation myself.
Oh, that's
when my best friend,
good.
My best friend and I decided that we were going to get a big net. We were going to seine our creek, you know, pull the net through and see what came up. And we had little tiny catfish and little bluegills and all that. And then we looked down, we realized that we had leeches on us. We're still in the water. And that concerned me, but my best friend started screaming and leaped out of that. I'd never seen a man any human being make a rooster tail like he did. leaving that water. So
that would have been me, and the whole neighborhood remembers my scream, and I just stood there screaming at the top of my lungs till someone took them off. I mean, it's, and then I never went past that certain bend in the creek, and I'm not kidding. It was like, I am never having that happen to me again. It was awful.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Back to Last Child in the Woods. Kind of share with us what you observed in the book to be what is now, I consider, a staggering divide between children in the outdoors, and linking those observations to alarming trends with kids being disassociated from nature and things that are happening to their health, which I believe are all connected. They don't get outside. They don't exercise. They don't breathe fresh air. They have ADD. So make that connection that you so eloquently did in the book. That's a long question, but you have plenty of time.
Yeah. Well, the effects of that gap between children and nature, or children and the outdoors, are showing up in some unexpected ways. Even after The Last Child in the Woods came out, which is about 10 years ago, in fact, the publisher's coming out with a 10th anniversary printing of it, new cover. Just this morning, there was there's a story that was published in the scientific journal Nature that talked about East Asia being gripped by what they call an unprecedented rise in myopia, nearsightedness. In Seoul, South Korea, 96.5% of 19-year-old men are short-sighted. There are other earlier reports.
Repeat that. 96 point what?
Yeah. 0.5, I believe. 96.5. And remember, this journal is the preeminent, one of the two preeminent science journals in the world. And our earlier studies in Australia show that was true. And this is a huge increase in the last few decades. And the scientists, some of them believe they know why. One reason is reading. Now, we all want our kids to read. Nobody wants to cut back on reading. But when you combine that with the second reason, which is the second and third reason, which is staying indoors and looking at computer screens or, your iPhone or other electronic gadgets, video games at short range when you're looking at that, and not going outdoors, that amps up the threat of myopia exponentially, far more than reading. But reading is one of the culprits, but that's something we do want our kids to do. But if they're inside all day, just staring at something, a few inches or a few feet from their eyes, that's a problem.
Right.
When I wrote Last Child, when I was researching Last Child, that was predicated on research and writing that I'd done in a book that was published in 1990, which was called Childhood's Future. And for that book, I went all over the country and interviewed about 3,000 parents and children, usually in groups, in classrooms, and around kitchen tables. I really wanted to find out what the kitchen table conversation was about the future of childhood and family life. Like, I was not interested in the conference table conversation. I tried to stay away from experts. And what the parents told me, what the kids told me, the repeating themes of that became the chapters in that book. One of the repeating themes was that parents in particular had a troubling sense that there was some kind of profound change going on between what they had experienced with nature and what their kids were experiencing. They didn't have a language to describe that, so it was very difficult to articulate it. But even kids at that point, in the late 1980s when I was doing these interviews, had a sense that something had changed. I remember one little boy told me that the reason he preferred playing indoors is because that's where all the electrical outlets were. And another one said, he talked about watching, remember the TV show Lassie?
Yes, I totally do.
He talked about watching that and feeling like, Jeff and Porky. Can imagine playing a kid, Porky, on a TV show now. I like Jeff a lot more than Timmy. It came later. But Jeff got in trouble like I did. He got lost in the swamp.
Right.
And all that. And Lassie had to save him. And
that's so I could identify with that. Lassie wouldn't have been the hero if there wasn't somebody needing to be searched for.
Yeah, that's right. And I happen to have a had a colleague then that was actually quite a bit like that. This kid said when he watched that show, it was like watching Martians. It was so out of his experience. Now, that was in the late 80s. So I think that this trend began sometime probably in the early 70s and then very much accelerated. A case can be made that it started long, long time before that. It started with the invention of agriculture and then with industrialization in the 19th century.
Right, in our time.
But this big change has happened just within the last few decades, the biggest change, or arguably certainly the biggest change, you know, in the last century, happened during the last few decades. So at that point, though, it was only anecdotal evidence. Nobody, or very few people, were actually doing any research on this. The people who study child development and human development had virtually ignored the impact of the natural world on children and on the development of brain architecture and all of those other issues, which I think is something of an academic scandal that this was ignored for so long. But then after the book that I wrote with that chapter came out, the chapter was picked up by Utney Reader and Sierra Magazine. And in the following years, I continued to write about this issue as a newspaper columnist, and it continued because research finally started showing up. Most of it was correlative research. It did not show causation; it showed a correlation. But it's very seldom that an expanding and ultimately, finally, significant body of research that is correlated points in the same direction. That's very unusual. Today, finally, people are reporting the results of some longitudinal studies that do show some causation. So that research combined not only on the gap. I mean, there was research finally done on how little time kids were playing outdoors. And that combined with another body of evidence, which showed the great benefits to physical health, to mental health, to cognitive functioning, of literally being in nature, not just being outdoors, but being in nature. That set of studies began to grow. So at that point, I could write a book. It was not just about anecdotal evidence.
And it really was the first book of its kind that I say was kind of a marriage of sorts that really brought the solid research about contact with nature and made the connection to healthy childhood development, the physical and emotional health of children and adults. And let me just ask you one kind of sidebar question. My background is solidly in social services, and my Mrs. Green journey, the newest and at the oldest time in my life. But what do you think really happened? I had a stay-home mom, so we played outside after we got home from school. The deal was do your homework, and then you could go outside till it got dark, and my dad came home, and we all ate dinner together. Then I was a working mother, two-parent working, you know, parents. But I got news for you, Richard. Our kids love nature. We made a point on weekends, picnics, drives. You know, kids, they went outside even in our backyard. It was a lot less than I got to do growing up. But innate in us, both of us, my husband and me, was let's take the kids on a picnic. Let's go on some of these back roads in Arizona, of which there are many. And see cows and elk, and we've seen bears and lynx and all that stuff. And the kids today love it. So do my grandchildren. But what happened that parents didn't start noticing how important it was for their kids to get outside? And you have to answer that in 1 minute and then come back to it after the break. When I do that, I annoy myself. It's like, it's a really important question. What happened, Richard?
Well, how about we come back to that after the break? But in the meantime, I should say that you mentioned Last John being the first book. There were other people writing on this and working on this. David Sobel on pieces of it. David Sobel of Antioch had written wonderful books, including Ecophobia, and he was an expert and is an expert on experiential learning.
It's great of you to shout out. I mean, your book, Last Child in Nature, gripped my soul, so it's getting high kudos. Everybody, stay here with me. So much more good information to share. You'll want to hear it. We'll be right back.
University of Arizona professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
For almost 40 years, Bookman's Entertainment Exchange has been the place for used books, music, movies, and video games in Arizona. From the latest bestsellers to out-of-print classics, we have you covered with 3 Tucson locations. And now you can buy, sell, and trade musical instruments. Our newly expanded sections are chock-full of top-notch instruments. From beginners to seasoned musicians, we've got something for you. Open 7 days a week, shop, hang out, and enjoy our free Wi-Fi. Bookman's, good for your pocket, good for the planet.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. The name of our show today is A Daily Dose of Nature, and I'm honored to have as our guest Richard Loew. Among his many accomplishments, Richard is the author of The Nature Principle and The Last Child in the Woods, which is a national bestseller. He is also co-founder and chairman emeritus of the Children and Nature Network. Richard, thank you so much for being with us and for answering my long questions and for everything you do. So let's talk about what happened. What happened that we had stopped going outside, period, so many of them?
Well, quite a few things happened. One is obviously electronics have exploded in terms of the use of that. Although I'm always cautious about that, about bringing that, I bring it up obviously, but I always qualify it by saying that, many reporters who write about this want me to blame it on video games. And while I have some kind of harsh views of the industry and of the kind of silicon faith in education and computers, it's not the it's one of many reasons. And if we focus too much on electronics, kind of two things happen. First off, the kids love to do whatever it is their parents don't want them to do.
Right.
So if we demonize something like our parents demonized rock and roll, we're going to want more rock and roll. So that's as a practical matter, it's not a good idea to demonize anything in that fashion. But the other reason is that if we pick one thing, then we ignore the others. And the others include fear, which has been produced largely by the entertainment and in particular the news media, which I'm part of or have been a part of. It's somewhat related to reality. In some neighborhoods, it is unsafe to be outdoors in neighborhoods with gang warfare and all the rest. That's the reality. But in most neighborhoods, they're far safer than we're led to believe. And we're led to believe that the boogeyman is right outside our door by news media that all you have to do is watch CNN or Fox. You'll see how they take a handful of terrible crimes against children, and then they repeat that handful every year over and over.
I know.
And that's the very definition of conditioning. So that's part of the, you know, the actual proportion of the actual number of violent crimes toward children outside the home has been going down for at least three decades. But our impression is that it's skyrocketing. It is true that people who know the family and family members are in fact often the people who take kids.
Right.
It's not the strangers.
Absolutely right.
There's relatively few. Now, one is too many, but there are relatively few stranger snatchings. But having said this, I would recognize and say that I'm the last person who will want to shame any parent for feeling afraid. My wife and I felt that fear, too. And I knew better because I've reported on those statistics in the 80s, or in that book in 1990. I reported, for instance, there was a study. Remember when everybody was terrified of razor blades and pins in Halloween candy?
Halloween. I knew you were going to bring that up. That I just knew that's what you're going to say. Halloween was one of my favorite as a kid. And I'm happy to say that there is some swinging back in neighborhoods around here. There are just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids that are experiencing the Halloween I did because parents are taking back the night.
Well, the in that book in 1990, I interviewed an academic who actually at the peak of that fear did a study. He did a content study in newspapers, and he looked at every account of somebody finding a pin or something hurtful in their candy on Halloween. He did not find a single reputable report that it was a stranger. What he found is that, yes, people who knew the family and relatives in particular were doing that.
Right, again.
So, you know, and yet we fear, you know, everybody on our block. So, but the problem is that knowing that doesn't make us less afraid, and it's because of the constant conditioning. Everywhere we look, billboards, television, you can't walk through an airport without Wolf Blitzer warning you that you're going to be killed by somebody. So that fear permeates our society, and it's not going to change. News media is not going to change anytime soon. So what that means, I think, is that we can't wallow in nostalgia about the way we connected with nature as a generation. We have to come up with different ways for our kids in the future to connect with nature.
And, you know, I'm happy to report my show producer has two young kids, and boy, is she taking the lead. They have block parties. I mean, it's unbelievable the things they do. Her kids go outside and play in their cul-de-sac after school, things that I used to get to do, but it's definitely been a knock on the door, get to know your nature, your neighbors, have some potluck. So that's kind of exciting. I want to talk about, because I knew this was going to happen, because there's so much content when you get a guest like you, but there's one condition, one chapter in the book that really grabbed me that I wanted you to talk about a little bit. In some neighborhoods, we go through it around this part of the country about solar, and you know, neighborhood associations saying you can't put solar on. So a law was passing, oh yes, you can, because you know, homeowners associations are trumped by the legislation. But you talk about the criminalization of natural play and a particular character, Mr. Rick's Neighborhood, I think that was his name. And I, of course, thought about Mr. Rogers, but can you talk a little bit about that? And is that changing any from when you wrote the book?
It may have gotten worse. The criminalization of natural play has to do with not only government, not allowing kids to build tree houses, for example, but But the rise of private government and the rise of fear of litigation. In the case of government, we're seeing, of public government, we're seeing examples of that recently with government after, you know, municipality after municipality suddenly banning sledding because of fear of liability. Yes, kids get hurt sometimes, but we seldom think in terms of comparative risk. What is the price that will be paid by many, many more kids of never being able to go sledding, never being able to go down to a lake?
I know.
And look at the water by themselves.
Go out in a rowboat.
Yeah. So that's an example recently of this criminalization of natural clay, is the number of cities that have banned sledding. Another example, though, is in regarding private governments. In the last 40 years, I wrote a prior book. My first book was called America Too, and it was, I believe, the first book that looked, in part, the book looked at the rise of private governments, these community associations in America that often govern these private developments, private developments, gated communities,
right,
but also not gated communities, just new ones that are covered by CC&Rs, covenants and restrictions, and then governed by private governments, which, you know, it's the fine print that we all fail to look at when we buy a house, which, you know, just try to put up a basketball hoop in some of these neighborhoods, let alone let the kids play outdoors and make a treehouse or a fort. It's not going to happen. I mean, the community association folks will come around and tear down the treehouse. It happens literally.
It's just beyond words to me. I mean, my husband and I are like the little old ladies, late grandma and grandpa of the neighborhood, and we stand out there when the kids get off the bus because we're so happy to see the young energy, and we encourage them to run through our yard. But I got news for you. There's a lot of older, crabby people. I know it's not just them, but it's like, it's disturbing to me to have that attitude because, you know, to me, kids are life.
Yeah, I tell kids to get off the lawn all the time. No, I don't. That's a joke. And it's an interesting angle on that, which is, you know, one of the things that happens with kids that come from families with problems is the resilient kids are the ones that know what they need and go out and get it,
right,
from other people, other adults.
Right.
That's that's what happens with those kids who become resilient. Kids used to be able to go down the block. I certainly did this, and find a surrogate grandparent, find somebody, an older couple who would let you come in and borrow their kids' books that are off to college. And when I did that, I had a whole set of Pogo books that were given to me by Mr. and Mrs. Marcos. It used to belong to their son, who was off in college and didn't really want him anymore. And I loved going over there. They feed me cookies and milk and all of that. But there were also older men and the retired men in the neighborhood who perhaps left the garage door open. They'd be in there working at their wood bench, and they'd invite you in as a kid,
right,
and teach you how to use tools.
Right.
So those people are extraordinarily important to kids. And those people aren't there anymore because the older man closed his garage door because he was afraid of being accused of child abuse. And that's one of the prices that we're paying for this fear.
It's really heartbreaking. And I mean, I'm a part of that journey. It really is true. They don't want to get sued. And they don't want to get accused. I mean, it's really devastating. What about go ahead.
Well, one of the ironies is it not only is violent crime outside the home less than we think it is, but nuisance lawsuits, the stuff that people are so afraid of in terms of liability, nuisance lawsuits have actually been decreasing in number in recent years. I remember that one speech I made afterwards, they gave me a reception, and there was a very high-powered lawyer there who was angry with me for talking about, the parents not only fear strangers, they fear strange lawyers. And he said,
I remember that line.
Yeah. Well, he got upset with me, and he said, "Don't you understand that nuisance lawsuits have been going down?" And my response to him was, "Then why haven't you been telling us that? Why hasn't your profession been educating people that nuisance lawsuits are on the decrease and that people have less to fear in terms of litigation than they think they do?" And he didn't have any response to that, because it's really not in their interest to let people know that they shouldn't fear lawsuits.
And it's categorized as good news, which in general is not really smiled upon in the media.
Yeah.
It's one the most common thread of guests I have on my show, and this is not, high praise for Mrs. Green. It's, I want to hear the good news. You have lots of good news that you've shared, and bringing things to light and solutions. And I could not agree with you more about where is that in mainstream media. You're not finding it on Fox, that's for sure.
I have to qualify this because the basic idea of Last Child in the Woods was negative. The basic idea was nature deficit disorder. And I actually had that in the first draft of the book, but it was only on one chapter, which had to do with attention deficit disorder, which is related to this issue.
Right.
But the publisher insisted that I put it on the cover in the subtitle. I didn't want to do that because I'm a hoity-toity journalist, and I would never stoop to bumper sticker approaches. And they persisted, and I finally realized that they were right. I went back in, and the book needed a kind of a narrative spine anyway. And that became something that was used to hold the book together throughout the book, and it did go on a subtitle on the cover. And my resistance to it shows what I know about marketing.
Yeah, because you were dead wrong. It got attention.
it did, and it's entered the language, and it's in several languages, by the way. And that's why I think we had, and I made a decision, because I kind of resisted that kind of approach myself. But I decided that even though I thought I would get a lot of flack for using such a corny medicalizing phrase, I decided that was worth getting that flack, because if we didn't use some phrase like that, we would not have this conversation as a culture that we needed. So it was a roll of the dice, and it worked. And I've gotten very little pushback for that, a little bit. Some people think it's medicalizing, and some people think it's fear-mongering, but very few people. Most people hear nature deficit disorder, and they understand it immediately. It doesn't require a lot of explanation. Having said that, at least half of the book or more is about solutions.
The
nature principle. It's about innovation. And the whole point of the Children and Nature movement is to help build a movement that is a positive movement that brings people together instead of driving them apart. It's one of the only issues that will actually bring people who don't agree on anything politically into the same room, who normally don't want to be in the same room. So, there's enormously positive and hopeful things that have come about in the last 10 years.
And easy things that you can do. They're really how-to things that are so possible that, may need to be the spark for new ideas for people, that because you just get into these habits, come in, turn the TV on, get dinner ready, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, to me, yes, there's a lot of really good news in there, too. And I rarely think we get to see an author who writes a book and then eventually comes out with a new edition that not only gets to report on the enormous changes that have taken place, but things that have been put into action since the book was originally published. And it's okay for me to give high praise to you, because it's very genuine on my part. It's near and dear to my heart as a nature lover and a mother and a grandmother. And Unfortunately, we are going to have to take another break. So when we come back, you get to decide how much we talk about your other book, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. How's that for positive? And then the Child and Nature Network that you have and the big gala that you have come up in April that's already sold out. So we'll just take a quick break and you get to think about that. Everybody, I know you're going to want to stay here because when I get the sign for the break, I'm not tracking because I'm listening. Everybody stay here with me. We'll be right back with Richard Love.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
The Habit Store is a big operation with staff and volunteers working hard to reduce our carbon footprint. We sell donated building materials, furniture and appliances, and recycle the metal from items that we can't repair or sell. We even have solar panels on the roof. The good deals we offer shoppers means Tucson Habitat can build and renovate homes for hardworking people. The Habit Store's store hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturdays, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road, just east of I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. You're listening to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And certainly, we are getting a lot to think about today. Please remember to visit our website at MrsGreensWorld.com to download our free mobile app so you can listen to great podcasts like this. And just a little story. I got an email today from a man who I don't know who said that the one of our shows in February was not It was looping on iTunes. And you know, folks, we love to get emails like that. We're on it. We're having our tech people look at it. And that makes us know that you're listening. And please follow us on whatever your social platform may be, your favorite. Mrs. Green has them all covered. And while you're on the website, please take a look at our membership model and hopefully get excited about becoming a Mrs. Green's World Sustainer, which helps support free and independent radio and helps us have the PBS of Internet Radio, and bring to you great shows like this. Joining me today is Richard Love. Richard is a journalist and author of 8 books, including Lost Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder, and The Nature Principle, Reconnecting with Life in a Virtual Age. His books have been translated into 13 languages and published in 17 countries, and he helped launch an international movement to connect children and their families to nature. Richard is co-founder and chairman emeritus of Children and Nature Network, an organization helping build the international movement to connect people and communities to the natural world. So, Richard, you get to say that you're a hoity-toity journalist, author, because you have a lot of accomplishment that makes me feel like you're not that at all. So I'm glad that you took the time to be on my show. You're a thought leader and a change maker. So
Thank you.
Do you want to talk about, I just want to read this one quote because I think it just kind of synthesizes everything. It's on your website and it's a quote that you made about the nature principle. The future will belong to the nature smart, those individuals, families, businesses, and political leaders who develop a deeper understanding of the transformative power of the natural world and who balance the virtual with the real. The more high-tech we become, the more nature we need. You just want to expand on that content-rich quote. Is there anything more you can say about that one? That packs a wallop, as they say.
Well, thanks. That last phrase about the more high-tech our lives become, the more nature we need, is a kind of an equation that I think it's a kind of a budgeting equation in a sense, in that of time and money and attention that, yes, our world is becoming more high-tech. That's a good thing in many ways.
Right.
And I love the internet. It makes my job a lot easier. But the more high-tech our lives become, the more nature we need. And the reason that is because nature provides us, or experiences in the natural world provide us with a sense of balance and a stimulation of the senses that are going to atrophy if we spend all our time in the virtual world. So whether it's in our schools, where I think for every dollar we spend on the virtual, we need to spend at least another dollar on the real. Or our neighborhoods or our homes or our lives. I mean, if we look around our home and look at the backyard and think, you know, what if there were a lot of native species instead of just Kentucky bluegrass?
Right.
What could happen in terms of the enrichment of our life and those lives out there in the enrichment of biodiversity? You know, what if we changed our yards? And this is discussed in the nature principle. What if my wife and I decided to do this. We put in a lot of native species in our backyard, and native butterflies, California butterflies are showing up we've never seen before, native bees. You know, the honeybee and the bumblebee are both invasive species, but there are these native bees that are showing up. And then, you know, bees are good, whether they're invasive or not. But we're seeing this life emerge. We're seeing a food chain begin to enrich it. We're seeing more biodiversity in our backyard. What if it wasn't just our backyard? What if it was the next one and the next one over and the next one beyond that? What if we declared, as Doug Ptolemy, a botanist in the University of Delaware, suggests, what if we just declared the first homegrown national park?
Oh, my gosh.
And this would be you and me and the school and the community garden and the neighborhood, people doing it on their own and creating, in essence, wildlife corridors throughout cities.
Right.
And what if we even thought larger than that? What if we thought about a worldwide homegrown park? So kids sitting in a school in San Diego can talk via Skype to kids in Kenya about how they're both building the world's homegrown park. And the school sends home seeds and seedlings with them, and the Natural History Museum does the same thing. What if we had that kind of charismatic idea that would give people a sense of power and hope? I mean, that's just one idea that among many ideas that are out there that are beginning to be planted and beginning to grow. I heard a quote the other day, and I'm not, you know, I'm a journalist, and so by genetic training, I'm allergic to happy news for happy news' sake. But innovation attracts me, and. Just yesterday, somebody called me. I'm trying to track down the origin of this quote, but I think it's wonderful, and it kind of sums up what the nature principle is about, and so much of which is it's too late to be pessimistic.
I want you to track down that quote. Can we just Google it? Oh my gosh!
I tried. I'm still looking at various people's.
Let me know. But what a beautiful picture of a worldwide homegrown garden. And I've had guests on the show. We did some things. Like we put up a finch feeder because we have finches all over the place. And where I prepare for my show is a songbird's heaven. The hawks come in to get the quail that are on the ground eating the finch food. But I have a little habitat right outside my window. The butterflies come, the hummingbirds come, and talk about bringing great joy to me when I'm doing my work. But I want to ask you this question, and I want to make sure I asked you before we got off the air, and we still have time, but I see what I call a really growing great divide between the very rich and the very poor when it comes to the issues of water security, food insecurity. There are great people doing things about it. I'm not a pessimist. But does having access to the natural world create an even greater divide, or is this an opportunity for the rich, the poor, and the middle class to participate and have access to nature?
Well, first, in terms of the barriers, I think that it's true that someone in an inner city neighborhood, and there's all kinds of inner city neighborhoods, you have to remember that. There's
right.
some that are affluent. But someone in an inner city neighborhood that has a lot of crime, et cetera, is, you know, if there's used condoms and hypodermic needles in the park, your kids aren't likely to use that park. So that it's true that it is harder to have more direct access in some neighborhoods. On the other hand, there are other barriers, and we mentioned some of them before. In an affluent gated community, just try to step on the grass. And so the people may have the money to do these things, but it doesn't mean they're going to do them. So we have to think about this, I think, across the board as a human right, that until we think about this as a human right, we'll think of it as a nice to have, not a have to have. And it'll be treated as a soft issue. But I'm pleased to say that, and this is something I wrote about in some length in the Nature Principle. First, it was an Orion magazine article, and then Nature Principle, making the argument that this needs to be seen as a human right. And the reason that is that when you look at all the studies, all the research that's coming faster every day, some of which I reported about in each book, not only of children but adults for attention deficit disorder, kids with that. The symptoms go down with just a walk through trees in an urban park. Myopia, we mentioned. Obesity, there's a connection to that, to child obesity. Neighborhoods that are greener, even in dense urban areas, through green roofs, through community gardens, through different ways of doing it. Those neighborhoods, there's less child obesity. Cognitive functioning. Recent studies, a study of 900 Massachusetts schools. It's a longitudinal study, several years of study. It compared kids in green schools. By that, I don't mean solar panels.
Right.
Only that. I mean
right.
literally green, and literally community gardens or school gardens, getting kids outside on field trips, all of that. Those kids do much better on standardized testing. And again, they've taken out all the economic the factors that might throw that off. So this evidence of cognitive functioning, psychological health, the parks with the greatest level, the urban parks with the greatest level of biodiversity are the ones that have been shown to be the best for psychological health for human beings. So across the board, this appears to be fundamental to who we are. There are theories about this. E.O. Wilson's biophilia hypothesis is that we're hardwired to have an affiliation with the rest of nature. And then when we don't get that, we don't do so well. So if this is in us, if this is part of our humanity, anything that is essential to the best of our humanity, we have a right to that. That's the very definition of human rights. So in 2012, the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is thousands of nonprofits, NGOs all over the world. They had their once every 4 years worldwide conference in South Korea, and they passed a resolution that the Children Nature Network had some role in promoting. They passed a resolution saying that this is a human right for children to have positive experiences in nature and to a healthy environment. That's, symbolically, if it's only, and they're talking about taking this to the UN, but if that's only symbolic, that's fine, because that places this in a different category, that takes this out of the language of nice to have and puts it into the language of must have, because it's essential to our humanity.
And you're talking major numbers. I love to run the numbers, whether it's bad numbers, like every 6 seconds we use 60,000 plastic bags, or over 3.75 million kids are connecting in nature annually. And I love what your website said, not going back to nature, but going forward to nature through the Children in Nature Network. Those are big numbers, and ostensibly the numbers are even bigger than that. Those are the ones that you can capture. So that gives me hope.
Well, there's a lot of things happening. Family nature clubs are emerging. There's over 200 of those now. Those are multiple families that join together and, you know, two, three, five families at a time decide they're going to show up at the park and go for a hike on Saturday morning. It's kind of like meetup.com.
Right.
But there's now over 200 of those. In my city of San Diego, there's one that has 1,500 families. Just in the last three or four years, they built up that many. What if there were 10,000 of those in 10 years? At that point, we're talking, and these are self-replicating. These are, all you have to do is download a free toolkit from the Children in Nature Network website, which is childreninnature.org, and start your own. You don't have to wait for the Boy Scouts. You don't have to wait for some organization or government. You just do it. What if there are 10,000? At that point, we're talking about real cultural change. Just a few weeks ago, I was invited to Chicago. The White House invited me to Chicago. It was a great honor because President Obama was going to not only announce four new national monuments, he was going to announce the launch of something called a kid in Every Park initiative out of the White House, which starting next September, every fourth grader in America will get a free pass for that kid and for the kid's whole family to any national park or federal land in the country. The schools will be engaged to use these free passes for every fourth grader for one of those times. And this is as many times as a kid wants to go to one of these places with his or her family. They get in free too.
That's huge. I just have to say, that's huge because in even where I live, Saguaro National Park, it's $7 to get in.
Yeah.
So it's a barrier. So yeah. This is something now that I get the senior discount, it's okay for me.
Yeah, but you get $10 a year. You can pack the
You can go anywhere. You can pack a lot of park in for that. But that is just one where we shouldn't just gloss over it, press pause. You know, ring the bell, sound the good alarm about a kid in every park will get in is really good news for this country and for kids and families. That's amazing. And you should have been
the head of the National Park Service director told me that his goal, if they can raise enough money from private corporations for the buses, that's one of the things they're trying to do, you know, working with schools. They're going to try to convince schools that getting these kids out to these places is good for their academic achievement.
Yes.
But they've got to provide some transportation. If they're able to do that for the next dozen to 16 years, every fourth grader in America getting out, that will mean that a whole generation of kids will have had some experience in a national park or other federal natural lands. That's the kind of top-down change we need while the bottom-up change of family nature clubs and these regional campaigns happens. And there are other ones, the biophilic design movement among architects to create new kinds of schools and workplaces and neighborhoods. Pediatricians have gotten onto this. In 2010, I gave a keynote to the American Academy of Pediatrics, or national conference. I was a little nervous about it, but the response was terrific. There are pediatricians now in the U.S. and outside the U.S. who are beginning to prescribe nature, literally prescribe it or recommend it to their families. There's a physician called Dr. Robert Czar in Washington, D.C., who has organized D.C., all the parks. They've done surveys of all the parks. They've set up this thing where pediatricians there are prescribing nature to families and kids in the District of Columbia. And that's happening elsewhere. And finally, there's this.
And you have to hurry. Larger. Finally, we have about 30 seconds. I'm so sad. It's like
we have to put all of this in a bigger container. And the bigger container is that I'm convinced that most people carry around images in their head of the far future that are look a lot like Blade Runner and Mad Max. That's how we've come to think of the future, and that we have to change there. Martin Luther King said that, that any movement, any culture will fail if it cannot paint a picture of the world that we want to go to, that people want to go to.
Well,
that picture is out there, but I'm not going to call it sustainable because that's too narrow. I call it a nature-rich future, nature-rich schools and cities and civilization.
You get the last word, and thank you, everybody. Tune in next week, palm oil versus rainforests.